You are listening to the audio podcast of the King's Crossing Church of Christ. To learn more or to subscribe to our weekly podcast, please visit kingscrossingcoc.com.
We read from Genesis 50, 17 through 21. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of God of your father. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. I'm in the place of God. You intended to harm me, but God intended for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. You may be seated.
There was a master artist. He had created works in many different forms and materials, all of which were unique and wonderful in their own ways. Of all his works, the greatest were ones he began to create with a new kind of medium. He began to craft living stones. And as he formed them through a long process, he made them into portraits of himself. He took one such living stone into his workshop and began to look it over. He could see the stone was impressive, but he knew that for it to reach its perfected final design, there were parts on the inside that would need to be both revealed and also crafted. After a long and thoughtful look at his stone, he was ready to begin. So the sculptor took a large hammer in one hand and his chisel in the other and hit the stone with a swift, hard strike. Chunks of the stone fell away into a pile of rubble. The stone shouted in protest, "Why did you hit me? Pieces of me have now fallen to the ground. Some of the natural designs on the outside of me, some of the parts that I liked best, but now they're gone. What could you be doing? If you keep that up, I have a mind to leave this workshop." Quietly, the sculptor continued pondering the stone, looking at it from every angle, picturing in his head how it needed to be formed. While the sculptor was pondering, the stone began to adjust to its new form. It decided that there could be some beauty to what it had, even if it was different than before. But then, when the stone wasn't expecting it, the master took his hammer and chisel and struck the stone again, and even more pieces fell than before. Again, the stone tried to make sense of what was happening. "I've already lost so much. And now you've removed so much more of what I had left. I'm not in the same shape I was in when you started. People who see me now could hardly recognize me. Many of my favorite parts of myself are no longer part of me at all." Then for a long time, the artist began working with smaller, more subtle adjustments, tapping rather than striking, blowing the dust away, smoothing and polishing. But for the stone's perspective, these actions were small enough that very often it couldn't tell if the artist was even working at all. The stone felt diminished and wondered if the artist had, in fact, abandoned it entirely to go work on some other project. "Perhaps I'm too reduced to be useful," it thought to itself. Even so, the stone persisted there on the platform, trusting that the artist might be up to something that it couldn't perceive. Finally, the artist knew that the time had come. The stone was hoisted onto a new platform. Bright lights illuminated it on every side so that the most minute details of this stone were now visible. And on display, everything that had been concealed inside the stone was now revealed to be seen by all. Anyone who saw the stone could now tell who the artist had been because the stone had now taken on the shape and appearance of the artist who formed it. What is the purpose of life in this world? What is the purpose of going through being alive here in the world? We don't choose to be here. We're placed here. Along the way, we have choices. We have people who surround us. We have family. We have friends. We have opportunities. But left to ourselves to figure out why we're here, it's pretty hard to know exactly what it is that we're supposed to do. Is this world supposed to be some kind of a theme park? Is that what you were expecting out of life? That everything's pleasurable, everything's enjoyable, everything is here purely for your pleasure and your fun, and that's really the meaning of life? I mean, there's beauty here, and there's good here, and it's fun to talk about how life is good, and it's fun to talk about when we feel blessed, but the truth is, many parts of our life involve suffering. Much of life is suffering. So much of what we experience is not fun, but it's frustrating. And as the writer of Ecclesiastes says, a lot of times it ends up feeling like it's all in vain. It's like vanity. These things that happen to us, do they ultimately mean anything? He would say, we spend years growing in wisdom. I spend years of our lives learning lots of wisdom, acquiring knowledge of how to go about living life well, and then sometimes by the time we finally get smart enough to figure out what we're supposed to do, we're too old to have the energy to do much of it anymore. A lot of wisdom. Wish we could go back and communicate to ourselves as younger people, but just the way this is how life seems to be some of the time. If you're expecting a theme park, you're going to be sorely disappointed because life doesn't feel like that, does it? In this world, there is sometimes genuine malevolence. There are people who intend bad, who do bad, and who succeed in pulling off the things they're intending to do. Then on a smaller, more personal level, there are the things we set out to do and don't always succeed. We try to be the employee who shows harder work and greater integrity or good ideas, and then maybe someone else borrows credit for something that we did or claims something or puts up a facade, and then they get the promotion, and instead we get passed over. You try to be a person of integrity, and just the same, you still have illnesses and sicknesses and losses. And again, if you're expecting the world to be like Disney, much of the time you're going to end up sorely disappointed. If this world is just a theme park, we have good reason from time to time for wanting to get off the ride. So what again is the purpose of being here in the world? Is the only purpose of life to become a Christian and then get to heaven as soon as possible? Have you thought about that? I mean, if the only purpose of being alive is just to hurry up and get to heaven, then from the moment of your baptism, while you're still dripping wet, you might as well go ahead and walk across the parking lot to that funeral home and hop in a casket and wait. Right? If the only purpose of being alive is just to die and get to heaven as quick as possible, again, what is the purpose of all this time we spend here between the time that we're saved and the time that we go to be with the Lord? Why live at all if death is the only meaningful thing that we do? What is the purpose of life, and why do we go through it? Do you remember Joseph? Do you remember the person Joseph? When he was 17 years old, just a teenager, the Lord had decided it was time to start working on Joseph in some pretty big ways. He was the 11th of 12 brothers. And because he was born to his father at an old age, and because he was one of the two children of the wife that his father loved the most, he was treated really special. It was obvious to everyone that Joseph was the favorite son. While the older brothers grew up having to have the Walmart-style hand-me-downs, Joseph gets this designer outfit that's richly ornamented and colorful and beautiful, and everywhere he went, it was really clear who Dad liked the most in this family, who he had done the most for. Joseph was also a dreamer. These dreams that he had did come from God, and some of the things that God showed him in his dreams were that he was going to be highly favored, that he had a good path for his life, and great things were going to happen. But his dreams sounded so ambitious that even his doting father said, "Son, you could probably tone that down just a little bit. You know, you don't have to say everything just because it's in your head." But he annoyed his brothers, and then one day they saw an opportunity to get at him. They were out with their flocks, they were separated from the family, and he had gone to look for them, and they said, "Well, here comes the dreamer." And they intended harm to him. In fact, they were intending to murder him. And so in Joseph's life, with one swift, hard strike, his brothers took him and they threw him into a cistern. Again, the intent was for him to die, but instead, as they saw some merchants coming by, they said, why kill him when we can at least make some money off of him? And so they sold him to these slave traders, and off he was to Egypt. They just assumed they were never going to see him again. And surely, in that period in his life, I don't know what he prayed. I can't listen in on his prayers, but I have to imagine Joseph must have prayed, God, why did this happen to me? There are pieces of me that are now gone. Some of the things on the outside of me that I liked best have been taken away from me. My family's gone. I lost my robe. I've lost my friends. I've lost my possessions. I don't know what's going on here. What could you possibly be doing? So Joseph ends up as a slave in a wealthy man's house named Potiphar. Joseph happens to be a person of integrity, and in his quiet but persistent way, he went about being a person of God, showing his integrity, working hard, and it wasn't long before Joseph, even as a slave, is managing the entire household. It says that Joseph made Potiphar's life so easy that literally the only thing he had to worry about was what's for lunch. Nothing else mattered because Joseph had everything under control. He was running things with excellence. I would imagine that even though he hated being a slave, there are some ways that Joseph could have probably looked at his situation and said, well, if I'm going to be a slave, this is better than it could be. Maybe this is what I'm supposed to be doing. But things changed. There was another swift strike, and Mrs. Potiphar took a liking to Joseph. She tried to approach him, tried to seduce him, tried to get him to sleep with her. He was handsome, he was important, he was talented, and he wanted no part of this. And so when she could corner him somewhere, she grabbed him by his outer garments to try and force him to sleep with her. And it says that he just pulled on out of him and took off running. So you ever had one of your children who just had a hard time always like losing their shoes? Like Joseph seems to be one of these guys that's always losing his outer garments. I mean, they took his robe and now she's taking his next outfit. And so at any rate, he runs out of there and she doesn't want to lose face. And so she accuses him of doing the very thing that she tried to do. Terribly unfair. Life was terribly unfair to him at this point. And so Potiphar has him thrown in prison. And again, all of the things people had known about Joseph or assumed about Joseph as a person of integrity, as a person of character, as a person of wisdom, once again, he's had these things all stripped away from him. And if someone were to see him, they'd probably have a hard time recognizing him there in prison. It must have been very hard to tell if God was doing anything at all. It'd be easy to think of abandoning God entirely because following God right now sure didn't seem like it was paying off. But just the same, Joseph went about, even in prison, being a person of godly character. We don't know how long he was in prison, but we're told it was for a long time. That Joseph was in prison and once again worked his way up till he was, as a prisoner, kind of helping to manage and run things in the prison. And it wasn't until Pharaoh started having these weird dreams that Joseph had a new opportunity. So kind of trimming the story down a little bit for time's sake, a man for whom Joseph had interpreted a dream 2 years ago ended up working again for Pharaoh, had kind of forgotten about Joseph, even though he said, hey, remember me, I'm innocent, get me out of here. 2 years passed before the guy even thought about him again. But then when Pharaoh had those dreams, he said, I know a man who could interpret my dreams. And so Joseph is called up and given this opportunity to do an impossible task. Pharaoh said, I've had lots of guys just trying to pull the wool over on my eyes. I want you to tell me both the contents and the meanings of my dream. I'm going to tell you nothing. You have to tell me everything. Joseph had a clear perspective. I can't do anything, but God can reveal the meanings and the dreams or anything God wants to do. And sure enough, God gave him exactly what he needed. God gave him the interpretation of the dreams. And after Joseph told Pharaoh the dreams that had been in his own head and explained what they meant, he went on to provide some of this managerial wisdom where he said, you know, you got 7 years of plenty coming up. It's going to be followed by a 7-year famine. So if I were you, I'd store this here, be doing this, be working on this. And Pharaoh said, sounds like you just got yourself a job. And so straight out of prison, from the bottom of the barrel, suddenly Joseph is hoisted up and put on display in a new way that had never happened before. He's now second in command in all of Egypt. And then there is the biggest plot twist you couldn't have possibly seen coming. When the famine hits, after 7 good years, the famine hits for the next 7 years, and things get so bad back home that Joseph's brothers are forced to go to Egypt, where everyone's having to go, because Egypt is the only place that has any food left. And so then his own brothers show up needing to have something, needing some help. And of course, at this point in time, they can't even recognize him. They think he's long gone, possibly dead. They would never imagine in this moment that Joseph is the very person that they were going to ask for help. But you see, God knew that the time had come, and now in Joseph's life, he was hoisted up on display. He was in a position where people could see him, and these little details of his inner character and his heart were fully visible. Joseph not only forgave his brothers, but he protected them and cared for all of their families. They're reunited. As his father eventually passed away after their reunion, his brothers once again started fearing that Joseph was going to come after him once dad was gone. But the passage we had read earlier indicates that he had no intentions of any kind that even resembled that. And as many times in his life as Joseph has had people kind of strip the outer garments off of him, this is one occasion where no one had the power to take anything from him. He could have dealt with his brothers as harshly as he wanted to, but Joseph is the person in this occasion who chooses himself to be humble, to reveal himself to his brothers, to give them a new opportunity, to strive for love and forgiveness and mercy when he could have done absolutely anything else. So at this moment in Joseph's life, after all the hardship, we can really see the work of the artist who was shaping him, because you can see what was in Joseph's heart. His heart was overflowing with love and forgiveness, just like God's heart. God had been working on him. I don't know if I can say completely, you know, what exactly is the purpose of life? What is the purpose of your life? It's a hard question. But just the same, I'm convinced part of, at least, the purpose of this life is to be formed for the next life. The purpose of being alive, all the stuff that happens between our time of being saved, becoming a Christian, going to heaven, and even the hard stuff that we endure along the way, something about this life experience we go through is preparing us for the next life. So why is it that we don't give up just because things didn't go our way? Why is it that we don't quit when we're passed over or neglected? Why is it that we don't just walk across the parking lot and hop on into a casket and wait? Because the experience of going through life, the ups and the downs of life, are how God shapes us and forms us into the people that He's making us, the people that we're supposed to become. So the way that we as followers of God live life is we do what Joseph did. Whatever situation you're in, whatever it is that's happened to you, you continue to be a full participant in the life that God has given you. We engage life. We try hard, we work hard, we're honest, we dream big, we stretch ourselves. When good things happen, we celebrate robustly. When bad things happen, we weep. We stay fully engaged, and all along the way, we do this while clinging to God, who is at work on each of us. Sometimes in big, painful ways that we might could perceive, sometimes in wonderful blessings we can perceive, but much of the time I'm convinced the things God is doing on us happen just by our continued simple gestures of faithfulness, that we can't always see what He's doing. But the one thing that we don't do in this life is that we don't stay the same. You're not the same person that you were 10 years ago, certainly, probably not even 2 years ago in many cases. But God continues working on us. And so, for better or worse, we don't stay the same. This is our third lesson in a series that I'm preaching about humility. And we're calling the series, God is Greater. God is greater than our ups. He's greater than our downs. He's greater than our mountains, greater than our valleys, greater than anything in heaven or on earth. As we're trying to make this march towards becoming people of humility who treat God as if God is greater, we've talked about the first step, which is we really do have to let God be God, that we acknowledge God for who He is, and we try to make every decision with God in mind, thinking about our connection to God more than we think about anything else. Last week, we talked about the importance of learning to trust God's will more than we trust our own will. If God is actually greater and God knows all things, I really do have to entrust myself to Him and His design. What I wanted to talk about today is about the importance of patience in that process. We've got to be people who are patient because it takes time for God to work on us. And one of the challenges is, Paul describes us in Scripture as living stones. Another place he calls us living sacrifices. Even as we try to be a sacrifice on the altar, the problem with being alive is you always have that temptation to get up and walk away, to crawl back off of the altar, to move somewhere else, and to stop being part of the process. But we have to submit ourselves to God continually for God to have room to work on us. Now, we have the option of closing our ears and closing our eyes and closing our hearts, but God's not going to force us to pay attention, and He's not going to force us to grow. To be formed and to grow is something we have to wait for patiently and to choose to participate in. Really interesting study got started back in the 1960s and 70s. It was called the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment. Have you ever heard of that? Good, I'm going to tell you about it. So the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment was this study of delayed gratification. So what they would do is that they would take a young child, and they studied a lot of different children, but they would take a young child and put them in a room by themselves, and there on the table, they would set a marshmallow. And they had a few things, some cookies and some other stuff that they would try, but generally they were using marshmallows. And so they put this one marshmallow in front of the child and say, "You have a choice. You like marshmallows?" "Yeah, I like marshmallows." "Well, I'll tell you what, you can either have that marshmallow at any time you want right now, or if you wait until I come back, you'll get to have that marshmallow and another one. So you can have two instead of one if you're just willing to wait for it." And so they did this robust study of a lot of different children, and they watched the way that the children had responded to that initial test. Is this a child willing to wait patiently for gratification, or do they insist on it now? And what was so interesting was they went back and studied these children decades later to see what became of them. The kids who insisted on going ahead and chomping on the marshmallow versus those who were willing to wait. And what they found was there's all these bizarre areas of life that were better among those who were willing to wait for that second marshmallow. So things like SAT, ACT scores, higher among those who were willing to wait and be gratified later. Better educational attainment, better body mass index, you know, a lot of different random things that would be true of those who were willing to wait. If nothing else, this study taught us there is value in learning to be patient, trusting that more good can come later if we don't give up right now. If we're willing to wait for God to do it, God can and will give us bigger and better things, and we're better for it. I wanted to share a couple of verses with you. John 16 and verse 33. "In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart. I hear, be patient. Be patient. I've overcome the world. I'm in control of where things are going. Imagine your life as if it were a single journey up a mountain. Let's say that your entire life, we've talked about how do you picture your life. Maybe you could picture your life as if it were one journey from the bottom to the top of a mountain that you're climbing. Each person's climb will be different. Some of us have longer climbs, some of us have shorter climbs, but all of us are not going to reach the top if we don't climb. And as you do it, there's no need to rush past the journey because the mountain's not going anywhere. It's simply there for us to keep climbing. As we think about what to do with this question and with Joseph's story, first I would invite us to make sure that along the way we keep our identity intact. Keep our identity, keep your integrity intact. Joseph was in a lot of different circumstances, many not of his own choosing, but just the same. No matter what circumstance we're in, we can choose the kind of person that we're going to be. We could talk about the Apostle Paul doing the very same thing. When he was in positions where he was invited to speak to government leaders, he was going to be a sincere Christian in that context. When he was thrown in prison, he was going to be a sincere Christian in that context. And everywhere he went, he made an impact because he chose the kind of person he was going to be, and he kept that identity with him everywhere that he went. We have to keep our identity with us. We also have to keep a long view of our life and what it all means. We don't want to lose sight of why it is that we're here, because then we do get discouraged and bogged down with too many negative thoughts of why them and why not me and all those questions we tend to ask. We need to keep a long view of where it is God could be taking us and submit ourselves to that process. But then we also need to keep climbing, not to sit still, not to give up, but to keep taking steps in directions that we actually do want to go. You know, this is the thing about Christian obedience. If you're trying to base your walk with God on these emotional type experiences of God, sometimes we get those. I've loved those moments in my life, and sometimes they've helped fuel me for months and years after one of those emotional highs has occurred. They're good for us, just like the emotional lows can also teach us. But if the way that you're trying to have a relationship with God is to always expect you're going to have this good, perfect experience of God where it's almost tangible, much of the time you're going to be disappointed. But what God calls us to is not just always to have the experience, but to have obedience. That when God is very near, I'm going to walk with Him and I'm going to trust Him. But also when we're in those moments like Joseph had, where I can't even figure out if He's there or what He's up to, I'm going to keep being obedient. I'm going to keep being the kind of person I've committed myself to being, and I'm trusting that through this process, God is shaping me into the person I'm trying to become. One other verse I want to share with you is Luke chapter 6 and verse 40. One of my personal mentors, he's a professor at Lipscomb named Earl Lavender. He has this printed off on a small sheet of paper, and he reads this out loud every single morning, first thing when he wakes up. The student is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like their teacher. We're not above God. I'm never going to be above God. But when God has finished fully training me, I can become much more like God. We're not above our teacher, but we can become like our teacher. So in your life, if you're going through one of those seasons of despair where you don't really understand what's happening and you feel disappointed or frustrated with your outcomes, I want to encourage you not to give up, because you have no idea how God could be weaving these things around together for your good and your betterment. It could be even to the point that the worst thing that's ever happened to you, one day you're thankful that it happened. That happens sometimes, doesn't it? God can work through all of these things. Don't miss out on the opportunities of today because you're so focused on what someone else has today or what it is you're worried about for tomorrow. But in each day, choose to be a person who fully engages life as the kind of person that you've committed yourself to being. Because when we do this persistently and we keep ourselves there in God's workshop, praying to Him, studying the Word, gathering with our Christian family, God is shaping us into the people that He wants us to become. And when our moment of trial comes and that moment of truth that really reveals us happens in our life, people will be able to see who it is that's been shaping our heart. We can become like Him when we continue walking in His footsteps. So today, if there's some way that you are subject to the stuff we've been talking about and you've just got some stuff on your heart and you're struggling to hang on and you do feel like giving up, or there's just something that we could pray with you about. If you're a person this morning who hasn't really taken the steps on this journey that you need to take, you've not committed yourself to Christ in baptism, you've not really repented of the things that you've been doing, and you need to make some changes in your life, this is a moment that we set aside in our worship service where if you need to respond, you can. And we would invite you to come forward as together we stand and sing.